Support for KMUW's Into Music podcast comes from McClelland, reminding listeners that Frank Sinatra coined the word skibbity in Strangers in the Night, which you can listen to in their downtown Wichita showroom. More info on McClelland's innovative sound, lighting, and video technology can be found at maxsound.com.
Hi, I'm Jed Bodwin, and you're listening to Into Music from the KMUW studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network. My guest on this episode is John Lankford, co-founding member of the Mekons. The Mekons are back with Horrible, Mekons versus Tony Mamone in Dub Conference. It's a new take on the band's 2025 album, Horrible, and a deep collaboration with their longtime friend, Tony Mamone. Lankford recently spoke about the project and the various unorthodox methods that the band has employed in record making over the years, as well as the importance of dub in the context of music history and the present day Mekons fan base. That's John Lankford of the Mekons on Into Music coming up now.
Tell me about that, about the decision to do this new version of the album.
Well, there was kind of like two albums going on at the same time. The songs, you know, were written in the studio, and they were like, there was lots of unfinished kind of connections being made that things could have gone. There was a lot of material, and things could have gone in a lot of different directions. One direction was when we offered Tony to mix a few of the tracks to see, when we were trying to decide which way it would go. Dave, our bass player, what will mix the previous album, wasn't really available at that time. So we gave it to Tony to see what he came up with. We really liked it, but then Dave became available and we decided to finish the album sort of as the way it suggested itself in terms of the songs. But then what Tony came up with was stuff that took it in quite far-reaching sonic directions that we weren't really expected. So when it came down to it in the end, it was just this is like two albums. And we had this other thing sitting there, and Fire were kind enough to let us unleash it, finish it, and unleash it on the world. Our idea was that Horror should sound horrible, and the original Horror album, some of it's quite nice. So we wanted to eradicate any of that.
It does add this very eerie, unsettling feel to the music.
Yeah, I just felt like we gave him free rein to he wasn't there when it was recorded, and Dave was there when it was recorded, and so we were working towards making an album of 12 songs. What Tony got was like, he was completely confused, but really giving him a box of paints and telling him, you know, this is the picture, and he had to kind of assemble it. And I don't know, it was just he did a couple of mixes, and me and Tom really, really liked them and thought they were quite extraordinary. And he's someone we've worked with over the years quite a lot, but we've never really given him, you know, free. He was the bass player in the Mekons 30 years ago. So we'd never really given him free rein to just, you know, attack our stuff. And this was good. He's got a great studio in Brooklyn called Studio G, which it's just a really great studio. He's got a lot of really odd, older gear there. And, you know, I went in a little bit with him to sort of not really oversee, but just to sort of like see what he was up to and find out where it was going. And every time I'd send something to Tom, he'd be like, yeah, tell him to go further. I'll tell him, that's good. I like the bit where it kind of breaks down. You can't tell the song's disappeared, but there's this kind of sonic noise. It sounds like the speakers are broken or something. It's good.
Yeah, it was just wild to hear that. And I wanted to go back to that and just talk a little bit about the lyrical themes, if we could, which of course make their way across both. But was this like really a decision when you decided in 2022 that you were going to make this album? Was there a lot of talk about the kind of connective tissue thematically, or was that stuff that just kind of started to emerge and then you ran with it?
I'd have to say the way it works with the Mekons is we had the idea to go to Valencia in 2020. and we didn't go. And we made an album called Exquisite, which used quite a lot of the ideas that we were thinking about for the Valencia album. Then the pandemic miraculously died down, and we had the opportunity to go to Valencia. So we went with very little prepared, but we did have the title. And then from the title came other from the title of the album, then we would get down to titles of songs. Some of the songs would just, when we got into the studio, it was just three words written on a piece of paper. Then we would start making something that seemed to fit that. Yeah, some would call it ill-prepared, but it was, it made it a bit of an adventure. And the way we set up was as a live band with eight people sitting in a circle in a big giant studio with mostly unfamiliar equipment because we didn't take anything with us. So we kind of just used what we found when we got there. Fortunately, it was a fantastic studio full of grand pianos and Hammond organs, and all sorts of interesting synthesizers and great amplifiers, nice guitars. And you know, we just sort of made something up for 10 days. And that's why we didn't attempt to finish it. We didn't attempt to mix anything. We did get quite a lot of the vocals down by the end of it, but we were writing the lyrics and the melodies to what we'd made. That's what left it so open-ended, to be able to feel that it wasn't entirely complete without the dub version.
Well, working like that too, right? You kind of, you don't, I would imagine, go in with any, there's no preconceived notions there. There's no, we can't do this because we didn't do that on the demo. It's not, we can't do this because blah, 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 wrote that song.
What you, and when you hear the album, and somewhat so with a, almost more so with the dub record, is you like, you're seeing, seeing under the hood of the songwriting process. It's basically, you know, these are the bits we came up with. And then, I don't know, it's a kind of backwards way of doing it. But for a band that's so geographically challenged, who can't get together and meet and do demos and sit around together, it was, it's kind of the best way to do it. But I think we gave ourselves plenty of time with this, and normally maybe we would pressure ourselves to finish it, and with this record we didn't do that. We just kind of followed our noses and saw how far it would go. And a lot of the songs, like I said, there's a lot of decisions made in the mixing stage to chop out all areas or directions of a song, and some of those decisions are kind of reversed with the Tony Ramone versions. So it's, I mean, but you could have almost, it's almost like you could get 20 other people to mix it and they'd all come up with something. If we could afford that, it'd be great. But it was kind of a luxury bit to say to Tony, look, here we are, we have some money, you just sit and do it and go for it. And you know, it was, that was interesting to me to see someone else respond to it rather than us making all the decisions. So surrender.
Tony's interesting too, because he's got these, you know, he obviously has that avant-garde sensibility, but he's also done, you know, some pretty quote-unquote straightforward records.
Yeah, no, he's, I mean, he's a kind of all-around engineer musician. He's a great musician as well, I think. You know, his bass playing on all that early Peribu stuff is so kind of, I don't know, it's just insidious and dominant. It's great, you know. It kind of drives that thing along. And that's, that was one of my favorite bands. I couldn't, you know, sometimes I kind of pinch myself because it's like, well, when we got to open for Peribu in 1988, I thought that was pretty astounding. And because I'd loved them at that point for about 10 years. But, you know, that the very early stuff is so far ahead of its time. They were doing that before punk rock was even really mentioned as a thing. So yeah, and yeah, I mean, he's done at his studio, he's done, I mean, I've sat in at sessions, you know, he's a good friend, as I said, and I'd often stay with him. When he had the little studio G, he lived upstairs, so some nights if I was in town and I'd go and stay at Tony's apartment, he'd be in the studio with people doing reggae stuff, kind of like sort of Latin folk stuff. And, you know, he was, you know, the he was the go-to guy in Williamsburg for many, many years. He recorded an album of ours at a place called Jalopy in Red Hook, where we made up the songs. We wrote the songs in the van, and then we attempted to perform, you know, 12 new songs at a live gig with the audience taking part, which that's the album, Existentialism. And it wasn't even going to come out as an album. It was going to be a book. That was the idea. And you just got a book and a download, but not a model that many people enjoyed, I have to say. So we did come out. It did come out as an album, a vinyl album. But that was a really great experience. No, that came out on CD. Came out on CD. But it was just kind of amazing to make, you know. And he was totally in for that idea. He said, "Look, we just want a live recording, basically. We don't even want to mix it. We just want it to go down. Get whatever you can, and that's the record. It's finished." And the slogan we had at the time was, "Why does it take longer to make an album than it take to listen to it? And they should be exactly the same length of time." Of course, that's just bullshit. But it was fun having the audience and having, you know, bringing other people in and having. We had our friend Dave Nagler came in, and he was directing the audience as a kind of feral choir. And we had lyrics written up on bits of giant pieces of paper, and people were singing along. And it was making no sound effects, noises. It was Tony's job was to capture the whole thing, which was, I don't know, kind of piece of extreme field recording. And then it was almost like an apology for us to say, "Here, do what you want with this Meekins record. You know, you can." "We put you through hell. Now you can do a dub mix of this Meekins record at your own, in your own time, at your own. We won't bother you. We'll let you do it." So, I think that's what horrible turned out as. We just said, "Make sure it sounds horrible."
Just in reading the press release, you mentioned that there was this tour with Meekones and Pere Ubu, and that it was strange. What was so strange about it?
Well, we ended up doing quite a bit with Pere Ubu. Well, to be, I loved the band so much. That was strange. And I'd seen them, the Gang of Four had been out with them as well before. And I'd seen them with the Gang of Four many years before that. And I don't know. I don't think David Thomas liked the Meekons very much. He came round to us much later in life, but at the time, I think we were having far too much fun, and it was like a little bit, the situation was a little bit out of control. I think he was very controlling with the band. He didn't like them fraternizing with us too much, and most of the band enjoyed fraternizing with the Meekons because it was great, you know. Remember, we played in Leeds and we had a big party at my house, and David was the only one who didn't come to the party. And we were like, "Well, go wake him up, make him come to the party." You know, all sorts was going on. It was great, really good fun. They thought the Meekons were a good laugh. And, you know, we were, quite young at the time, relatively. It was great. And Tony, then we invited him to play bass with us. After we were dropped by A&M, we decided not to pack it in. You know, all the forces of good common sense and, you know, were telling us to sort of just give up. We failed again, and instead we had an album out that A&M rejected, but it was still kind of available in Europe through Blast First. So we decided to go on tour with that album. And that was around the time I was moving to the States, and Sally as well moved to the States. Steve was already living there. And we just I don't know, we assembled a band, and we had a guy called John Langley from the Blue Aeroplanes playing drums, and Tony came in and played bass. And it was kind of an amazing tour.
I think about, today, if somebody said that they'd been dropped by a label, it's like, well, yeah, that's just kind of what happens. When that happened, was it disconcerting, or did it feel like it threatened the future of the band?
It was totally. I mean, Steve and Lou basically just drifted away at that point. So, and the first time that happened with Virgin, which was almost exactly 10 years before, that band kind of, we ended up with just three of us, really, after that. So the original Mekons Mark One was, you know, just fell to bits pretty much in the wake of Virgin dropping us. And then, I don't know, I think some people felt that was the end of the road for them. It was like, you know, and I think it was for all of us actually after the first time, but then we just, me, Tom, and Kevin were socializing quite a lot and hanging out. It was like, why don't we do some music? We still see each other all the time. So, you know, that's where the second sort of era of the Mekons came in around, you know, 83, 84. And I thought we made some really interesting stuff then. And it was all kind of in the shadow of what we considered to be some sort of failure. You know, we just thought we were doing this out of bloody mindedness to, we won't go away and die, if, even though most people wanted that to happen. And when Fear and Whiskey came out, I don't think anyone really bought it in England, but we had Rhino was distributing it, and they were calling us up and saying, should we press up another 1,000 records? You've sold out. And we're like, well, who's buying it? And they said, oh, we were sending a lot to San Francisco, Chicago, and New York. And that was kind of, you know, my life, people's lives, just, you know, economic necessity or economic kind of forces drove us to go to America. You know, oh, they want to hear us over there. Oh, somebody wants to book a tour, you know. And I still think that phase of the Mekons is the one we're in now. It's, you know, that's a consistent band all the way through from about 84, 85, that we still have now, really. So,
what do you think the audience is today? I'm assuming that there's a lot of people from that period, but that you've also seen some, you know, newer fans and things like that come in.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting when you stand in, you know, I always feel like obliged to hunt them down after the show and say, what, you know, you were singing every word, what's going on? And then I remember this one woman saying, I grew up in a Mekons household, which is I don't know, sorry. I didn't know they had Mekons households, but there you go. But, you know, now a lot of people, after the documentary came out, it was interesting because we'd see sort of younger people at shows, and I think people thought, did your parents bring you? You know, and it's like, no, we saw the documentary. So I think that was a cool thing that which opened stuff up. And to be honest, the tours we did last year, particularly in the UK, in the USA, I don't know. I think we had more people coming to shows than we've ever had, really. So maybe it's just that our advanced and venerable age that people think they better catch up with us now. It might be the last chance.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because you mentioned Gang of Four earlier, and I saw them for the first time last year. I'm 53.
Yeah.
I don't think there was anybody, I mean, maybe five of us in that age group, and everybody else was under 30.
Oh, really? That's cool.
Yeah. And
well,
I was,
you know, I think it's a mixture with us, you know, but it's nice it's nice that people kind of get it, and it would be sad just to be playing to, you know, your own immediate peer group. But I don't, I like the olds coming as well. I like to see people my age still going out to gigs, so it's good.
I wanted to ask you about dub, because I feel like that's something that a lot of Americans don't get. Like, they don't understand it. But this was, like, in England, this was pretty significant.
I think a lot of people think of reggae I think it's a great bit in I think it's a UB40 documentary or some documentary about British reggae music. Or what I think someone in UB40 says, people think of it as this kind of frat bro kind of cocktails with umbrellas in them, kind of tropical escapism. And for us, it was the music of the inner city in a very harsh, bleak time. Reggae music was something that was constant almost everywhere, all the large urban centers in Britain. And the early punk gigs, there were no punk records, and people chose to play mostly reggae. That would be the soundtrack, you know, between bands. That was pretty much, I remember being like at the Russell Club in Manchester and hearing like amazing stuff, you know, and thinking, wow, what is this? And not knowing, not being an aficionado, but knowing, I don't know, just knowing that music existed and had been part of our culture for a very long time, even in sort of like pop reggae, like, you know, I Can See Clearly Now, and seeing I saw Bob Marley's first appearance on British TV on the Whistle Test, you know, thinking this is pretty wild. It's like but the dub stuff, once I got more into collecting, you know, I've got a lot of reggae records, and I liked every single you'd buy. You know, the B-side is version. It's not like another song mostly. It's usually just a version, and the versions were often more interesting. And, you know, we came from a culture where I was too young in my hometown of Newport, really, to do it, but there was a big West Indian community in my hometown, and Joe Strummer, interestingly enough, lived in my hometown for a while in about 73, 74, 75, I forget exactly when, before he went to London and formed the 101ers. And he told me that was the first time he heard people toasting. And basically the fresh records would come off. The banana boats came into Newport, my hometown, from the West Indies. And these sailors would bring records. And there was a Barbadian nightclub on Commercial Road in Newport called the Silver Sands. And underneath the Silver Sands was a blues, they called it. It was basically a place where they played records and you drank after hours. It was an illegal drinking place. And you'd have warm cans of special brew and Tennent Super and stuff like that. And I never went down. I would have been too young to have got into that. But I got into it, and the drummer described it to me and asked me if I'd ever been down there. And I was like, no, I never, you know. But he was about 5 years older than me, I think. But when I got to Leeds, those were the places we hung out in Chapeltown, you know, and a lot of the punk clubs, like John Keenan was booking the F Club. But he booked the F Club at a place called the Roots first. And then after it burnt down and they rebuilt it, it was called the Phoenix because it rose from the ashes. But it was, you know, hardcore West Indian social clubs who didn't mind the punk rockers coming in, just thought it was funny that, you know, you'd have the punk rockers are playing. So all the music in those places was all reggae as well. So no, we were kind of steeped in it. And the other thing about Strummer and The Clash was they wore it on their sleeves and venerated people like Lee Perry that I didn't really know about. And then some of the early punk gigs up in Leeds, we had local reggae bands. Rock Against Racism started up pretty soon because the violence on the streets up in the north of England were very, very scary and unpleasant. But, you know, you knew which side you were on. And we would do gigs with local reggae bands, and we were lucky enough to play with the Ruts and Misty and Roots one night at the West Indian, one of the West Indian centers in Chicago. I mean, there's a big West Indian community up in Chapeltown in East Leeds. That's where I ended up living, in that neighborhood. And some really good friends. I'm still in touch with some of them. You know, I've been in the States for 30 years, but I don't know. That was a very interesting time. And to me, if somebody, we had some German journalist, when Horror came out, started talking about the song, the first song, Western Design. It's the first song on the first album. It's got you know, Steve played drums with Elvis Costello on Watching the Detectives. So I don't, you know, which was bringing a reggae feel into, you know, some sort of punk rock, pub rock that Elvis Costello was doing. And this guy, first question was whether, is this cultural appropriation that white people play reggae music? And it was just, I nearly ended the interview. It was just this, you do not know where I fucking come from. And don't be being German on me. You know, come on, dude, I could ask you some questions as well. And I said, I don't think it's cultural appropriation to me. I consider, you know, I've lived in places I've been and the music I've listened to for over the years, you know, that's urban British music, a lot of that stuff. Dub thing, yeah, is like you said, we got into that because that's so crucial, you know, that invention, you know, Lee Perry, King Tubby, to take the technology, that's friggin' revolutionary, you know. And I was lucky enough to meet and actually play with Lee Perry, you know, on a boat off the coast of Jamaica a few years ago, you know. And we were in talks to make an album together, and it was, he died before that could happen. And, but we had plans to try and bring him to Chicago and make a record. And it was, yeah, I don't know. I feel it's like, yeah, that what happened on that island, you know, particularly, you know, it's just incredible. I'm endlessly fascinated. And I'm also, I love the fact I can always find things I've never heard before that came out of Jamaica at that time. It's like, what a frigging cultural melting pot. We're talking about where is actually addressing the British Empire's responsibility for enslaving those people. That's what that song's about. So,
well, yeah, I mean, with that dub, you also don't get hip hop.
You know? No, that's what many people don't realize. That and toasting is where hip hop comes from, and it comes from a West Indian community in Brooklyn. Border crossing music, you know, it's fascinating. And I don't know, yeah.
Yeah, I just think, you know, there's almost a recipe, right? If you've got an immigrant population, poverty, and a port, you've probably got a pretty good gateway to new music and great music.
Yeah. Well, that's my hometown is very much that. It's a, you know, seaport town in South Wales. My family, my dad's side were the townies, and they lived in the Newport. Were sort of more middle class, and you know, my dad was an accountant. His dad was a teacher. His parents were both teachers. It was doctors and lawyers in his family. But my mother's side, the family were from 6 miles away up the valley, all, you know, metal workers, coal miners, rugby players, basically very working class. And then you had the docks, and the docks was, I went to school with kids from kind of all over the world. And I mean, I'm not saying it was like a socialist utopia, but it was kind of a boom town when I was growing up. And it wasn't tension between the races, I would say. I mean, the kids that I went to school with, it was kind of like, you know, I played football and sports with them, and they were, the black kids were kind of, I don't know, it was, I had really good friends, and there was no, I never felt that, you know, it wasn't instilled in us, put it that way. It's Wales. I think Wales is quite welcoming, and there were old, long-standing black communities in Cardiff, Newport, and I don't know, it was just, and the Irish as well, big Irish town, Newport, lots of my friends were, you know, first generation Irish, or, you know, their families had come over. And it was, I don't know, it was a melting pot of stuff. On a kind of, it still is when I go back to Newport. I just love the way it's so freaking crazy, and people do weird shit. This guy's my age. I formed a new band. And I'm like, oh, great, what is it? Oh, yeah, we do this, and we wear these outfits, and we do this. And it's like, brilliant, I love it. When are you playing? And then on the new record, Benji Webb from Skindred, do you know that band?
Oh, yeah.
He sings, he does a version of Mudcrawlers, which basically is a song about Irish immigrants coming into Newport in the 19th century, as but basically the same equivalent as economic refugees coming in and then being, thrown in the workhouse, or worse still, thrown out of the boats in the middle of the night onto the muddy banks where a lot of people died. And they called them mud crawlers because they crawl their way into the town up the muddy banks of the River Usk, because they weren't allowed to legally dock them, but they'd come over as ballast in the potato boats because there was no potatoes. And they come to get coal, and they bring human cargo in return for the coal. It's so easy. I wanted him to sing that because basically he lives down by Newport Docks by the river. So, and he was game, but he's, Jamaican kid that I've known for a very long time. He's about as Newport as you could be.
Well, I'll close out on this. You mentioned earlier, turning this over to Tony, and then, but also you think you said, we could have other people do it. There are those bands that have done, sort of fan remixes of things. Would you be open to like opening up the stems or something to Miko?
I never really thought about it. No one's asked. If somebody asked, maybe we would.
There you go.
Yeah.
Let's keep it going.
I mean, I think that's the joy of it. And there's something very freeing about. I love listening to, I mean, I don't like the sort of digital dub music so much. The kind of a lot of the recent sort of developments in. Kind of boring because it's so easy to do. I like listening to the struggle. I like hearing King Tubby and Lee Perry when it's like, wow, look what they did there. How the fuck did they do that? That's incredible. So, yeah, maybe I'm a bit old-fashioned in that sense, but you got Pro Tools now and Logic and all these things. It's really kind of easy to do some sort of credible dub thing. But there's different ways to dismantle that equipment and imitate the classic dub.
You've been listening to a conversation with John Langford of The Mekons. The latest Mekons release, Horrible Mekons versus Tony Maimone in Dub Conference, is out now, as is the band's 2025 record, Horror, of course. Those are both available via Fire Records, and the two are available as a 2-CD set or digital download, while the vinyl editions remain standalone efforts. You can learn more about the release at firerecords.com. You can learn more about this podcast and all programming on our station by visiting our website, kmuw.org. Send us your questions and comments at info@kmuw.org and find all the latest programming notes on that website as well. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time, and as always, I'd like to remind you that our theme music is composed and performed by Torin Anderson.